The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, I don't usually hit you with a difficult question in our intro section here, but I'm dying to know which of Liverpool's five goals on Sunday afternoon was your favourite?
Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. We'll end it there. Bye for now. Yeah, none of them, as you can imagine.
Yeah, not a great day for Manchester United supporters. One that I obviously enjoyed, and it was well worth staying up until the 2:30 in the morning for. I've been on fumes all day, having to get up at 6:30 for work. But yes, a long day, but well and truly worth it. But we better move on then. And we're obviously here to talk about Japanese football. And joining us on this week's episode is Johnny Nicol. It's great to have you back on, Johnny. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Ben. I kind of thought when you asked me on, I might be on as a peacekeeper, so hopefully I'll be able to keep you two apart.
No worries. Well, we're separated by five goals, Johnny, so that's plenty of distance, so don't worry at all about that. In the weekend's match day 33 in J1, we had all 20 teams in action. Of course, last week's podcast was an abbreviated one, thanks to an abbreviated schedule with just seven games. So we'll turn our attentions this week at the start of the episode to the top of the table, of flipping the script from last week. And, well, for all fans of J1 title races, Sam, this year's edition was pretty much wrapped up on Sunday evening, wasn't it? Firstly, the defending champions and now champions-elect Kawasaki Frontale won 1-0 at home over Shimizu after a goalless first half. Leandro Damião's back flick from Marcinho's cutback just 2 minutes after the break secured a regulation win, I guess you'd say, the champions-elect. And at least you got to enjoy a 20-minute cameo from the returning Ryota Oshima that I'm sure warmed the cockles of your heart.
Oh, absolutely. The rest of the game didn't matter as long as he got on and just got through it. And I think he didn't get an injury. So, yeah, it's great to see Oshima back. And he looked less, maybe a little bit off the pace, but the first touch he did was a lovely little spin past the defender. So that was good enough for me and everyone else from the Ryota Oshima Appreciation Society. But otherwise, yeah, Kawasaki didn't really get out of second gear. I thought they controlled the game without creating too much, and then just second half they started quickly as they often do and hit Shimizu, and Shimizu really didn't offer too much in the way of a comeback.
Indeed. And Johnny, you asked us a couple of weeks ago when Scott McIntyre was on how to compare this soon-to-be title for Frontale to last year's edition, so you might as well answer your own question. How do you compare them, and do you think this one rates more highly for Toru Uniki and his side?
Well, honestly, the reason I asked Sam and Scott and yourself was because I don't think there is a definitive answer one way or the other, so it was really nice to hear all your thoughts. You said, Ben, in your answer that the fact that Kawasaki were so much better than everyone else last year, because, you know, Gamba were second in J1, but I almost felt we were, like, first in J1.5. Like, Kawasaki were, I know it's a cliche, they were in a league of their own. And, yeah, this year, I think, because watching the sort of the last Japan game, and you had Morita and Tanaka both in midfield, and then Mitoma's been tearing it up in Belgium, like, to lose three players of that quality, and then in this game, you look, Joao Schmidt, I think he must be injured, but Tachibanada came in and he looked really good. And I think you both mentioned, like, Marcinho, he set up the goal. He looks like a real addition already. If you pushed me, I would say this year. But last year, I think, was a pretty strong achievement. But, I mean, one question I'd quite actually like to get you guys' opinion on, maybe Sam first, is, like, Toru Uniki, because I think I saw a question on Twitter about, it's kind of comparing, because obviously Ange Postecoglou is a very popular coach from Australia. It's an English-speaking country. So on English-speaking Twitter, he naturally gets more praise, whereas Uniki sort of kind of is in the shadows a little bit. I mean, how highly do you rate Uniki, Sam? And do you think we tend to, because Kawasaki has been successful for so long, do we tend to downplay his achievements? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think it is downplayed. I think the thing with Postecoglou is he completely revolutionised the system at Marinos, so the difference was so stark in the way that he played, whereas Uniki took on what was being done before him. It was, it's only slight tweaks to the way that Kawasaki have naturally played for many years, so maybe it's not quite as noticeable, but what he's done, that Kawasaki, before he took over, were a team that were always the bridesmaids, and he has put them onto a winning machine, and he's got to take a lot of credit for that. I think the team play just as well, if not better, than the F. Marinos at their peak, and are very good defensively. He's got the balance right. I think, yeah, he's a terrific manager, and if Postecoglou deserved a move to Europe, which he definitely did, then the same has to be said for Toro Rinicky. But I just, for whatever reason, I don't see that being the case. But yeah, he has to get a lot of credit for the work he's done. And the thing is, as you said last year, it looked like Kawasaki absolutely blitzed the league and were so far away from each other. But the incredible thing is, this season, they have more points than last season, with a game still to play from last season. So yeah, what he's done has been absolutely incredible. And with the turnover of players as well, to lose such key players as he did, and then they had such a sticky period this season, but he's managed to come through that as well. It's, yeah, great resiliency. He's been a terrific manager. Just needs, the only thing that's missing, and Scott mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, is in those cup competitions, in the Champions League, can he transform the performances from the league into that? And that's the big hurdle. And hopefully for Kawasaki's sake, they can step up and do that next season. Yeah, what about you, Ben? How do you rate Toro Rinicky? I know it must be difficult looking across.
Well, yeah, no, it's just, it's all respect, Sam. I mean, yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal what he's done. As you yourself say, he's just turned them into a winning machine. And yeah, I don't know about whether he's interested in a move to Europe. I mean, it's something that, as to my knowledge, has never really been done, even at a lower level, by a Japanese coach. And it would be fascinating to see him. It would be great for Kawasaki's rivals if he did decide to chance his hand. But yeah, whether that's something that really interests him or not, or whether he's just happy to, you know, manage for Frontale for however many years and maybe move into the Japan job at a later date, I'm not sure. But it'd be fascinating. He'd be breaking new ground, and I'm sure he would do a terrific job, because yeah, he's an excellent coach. And I think you're both right, Johnny, with your question, and Sam with your answer. Yeah, we do. We have taken them for granted over the course of the last 18 months or so, I think. And with their performances, it's just been basically a given every week that Kawasaki's going to win. And huge credit to him. I mean, yeah, they've literally lost three of their five best players this season, and to, as you say, Sam, be on a better pace than last year is absolutely remarkable. And they are just about there after the weekend. As we said, a Sunday night was a seismic one in the title race. We're coming on to Yokohama F. Marinos and their defeat to Cerezo Osaka in the late game in just a second. But basically now, with Frontale 12 points clear with five games left to play, in baseball parlance, that means that Frontale now have a magic number of 4 points. That means that any combination of Frontale points won or F. Marinos points dropped that equal 4 will wrap up the title for Frontale. I mean, that could obviously come as early as match day 34. If both teams win in that next round, then it could come the week after that. But we know for certain now it will not go to the final day, because Kawasaki, as Sam said, with a history of being bottlers, they're certainly not that anymore. And it is basically in their hands now. And Shogo Taniguchi's got it halfway raised above his head. Another win for Frontale. And 84 points from 33 games is a remarkable return, no question. So on Sunday night, as I say, in the late game, F. Marinos travelled to Cerezo Osaka, and unfortunately for them, and again for all fans of a J1 title race, it fell 2-1. Cerezo made a perfect start in just the 6th minute when Takashi Inui was played in down the left. He cut back onto his right foot and saw his low drive from just inside the box deflected by Thiago Martins past a helpless Yohei Takaoka, and it was 2-0 15 minutes later when Mutsuki Kato finished off a back-to-front move. But This week in VAR. I don't know, Johnny. I think the VAR must have been drawing his lines with Microsoft Paint, as Kato appeared to me to be clearly ahead of the ball when Riki Matsuda squared a cross goal for Kato to tap in. I mean, it was a lovely passage of play with Kim Jin-hyun finding Naoyuki Fujita in the centre circle and his through ball sending the lesser Matsuda away. But, well, F. Marino certainly had an axe to grind there.
Yeah, I was actually, the first time I saw this was on Twitter, and it was a Gamba fan had posted a picture. And when I came round to watching the highlights, I thought, well, surely it must have, it's a Gamba fan, it must have been altered somehow to make it look offside. But I knew it was coming on here, so I watched it, and I watched it again, and I watched it again. And I can't see how that's not at least been reviewed to VAR. I was almost speechless to say, it's such a big decision in a big game, and it looks clearly offside to me. I mean, what about you, Sam? Have you got anything to add?
Well, we've long discussed lines on this programme, and generally we've got it wrong. And whatever it looks like on the pitch apparently is incorrect, and somehow the J-League Judge replay show will prove that the lines are not where we think they are. But yeah, I thought this was just about offside. Maybe they're using ultra-thick lines, so it doesn't count anymore. But yeah, there was this one. I mean, there's a complaint about the first goal as well. I mean, when the ball is first played forward, there's three players offside. And it then eventually works its way out to a few corners and whatnot. But yeah, there should have been an offside given right in the at the beginning of that passage of play. So yeah, things that Marinos will be very angry about in the way that they have conceded those goals and the manner of the offsides as part of that. But let's not take away from just how terrible Yokohama F. Marinos were in this game. I think I said last week that it was their worst performance since Muscat had come in. This topped that twofold. It was dreadful. They had little to no midfield. They were cut apart so easily by Cerezo, especially in that first half. And then second half, when Marinos have to go for it, you'd think, okay, a Postecoglou team will come out, go for it, just be direct, be, yeah, really pacey, dynamic. But this team, they set up in a 4-4-2. It was like we'd gone back to English football in the early 2000s. It was just trying to whip in crosses to Sugimoto. There was no thought about it, no ingenuity. And it was just like, if this is what Marinos are to come, then, I mean, yeah, I feel for their supporters to have gone from the way they were playing. It was so obvious that they had to continue in the way that Postecoglou was playing, but this was such a step backwards. And it was, yeah, a really poor performance, despite the injustice maybe of the two goals.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting, Sam. I mean, yeah, from the highlights package that I saw, I mean, it didn't look that bad, but obviously that's just a snapshot of a few key moments of the game. So it's really interesting to hear you say that, because, yeah, obviously they had basically a half to probably get themselves back in this game after Yuki Sanato guided in a lovely header 2 minutes before the break from Kota Mizunuma's corner. But, well, yeah, it just hasn't happened for them in the past couple of games then. And as you said last week, it was the first time you'd really noticed that it was Kevin Muscat's team. And, well, yeah, if his it looks like his fingerprints are all over it now. And, yeah, you've really noticed a really stark change in the past couple of games.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, their biggest threat in most of this season has been Elbert and Maeda out wide, and because they've got the pace in behind, and the other will cut, come across the box, and you'll cut it back. That's a Marinos goal. That's how they've worked. But playing Maeda up front, it just kind of lost everything that was about him. He couldn't really get in behind because Cerezo sat really deep and dealt with him fairly easily. And yeah, Sugimoto has done okay when he's come off the bench and he scored a couple of goals. But when you just playing it out wide and crossing really from deep and just hoping that Sugimoto will do something, it's just really unambitious football. It's not what F. Marinos are set up to do. They've not got the players, I don't think, to do it. That system can work. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world, but I don't have the players to it. They weren't playing to their strengths. And yeah, it was just really disappointing. And just some of the selections as well. Like in midfield, I've gone on for a lot in this podcast that I think Takuya Kida is their best midfielder, but they dropped him. They played Iwata in there, who's really a sort of wide centre-back, and they played Watanabe there, who's barely played this season. They just were AWOL for that first half. It was so easy. You saw with the second goal for Cereza, the way that they just moved it from the edge of their own area to the F. Marinos area in like three passes. It was just completely open for them, and there was no pressure on the ball. It was just, yeah, it was just so far away from an F. Marinos performance. And I'm not an F. Marinos supporter, I'm just a neutral, but it's so infuriating for me to watch it. So I don't know how F. Marinos supporters were feeling watching it.
Yeah, all right then. Well, it looks like Kevin Musk's got a bit of work to do in the last five games. Obviously, F. Marinos are well and truly locked into the ACL places, so they'll be in ACL action next year. And, it's going to be a really interesting last few match days of this season, and then as they get ready for 2022. But from a Cerezo perspective, even though they were somewhat fortunate with the decisions for their two goals, that is a first home league win for caretaker manager Akio Kogiku ahead of a big week for the club, Johnny. An Emperor's and Levain Cup doubleheader against Nagoya coming up.
Yes, I think, Sam said that Marino's made a few changes. I saw that Cerezo had made some changes. Whether it was to rest him for the cup games or... I know Kogiku seems to have come in, I think, just to the end of the season, but he seems to have been tasked with sort of bringing down the average age of the squad. Inoue was credited with the goal. I'm not quite sure if his signing really helps that with Okubo and Kiyotaki and other older players up front. But yeah, he seems to have brought in, because Sam mentioned Takuya Kida. There was Hinata Kida played for Cerezo, and the two young centre-backs there as well. So, I mean, Kogiku, I don't know what exactly his remit is, but if they were to go on win cup double, they're stuck in mid-table in the league. They don't really have to focus much in the league now. They're not going down. They're not getting to the ACL from that. So, yeah, Nagoya away in the Emperor's Cup. And then, obviously, you're commentating on the big Levan Cup final. Both one-off games. You would probably fancy each team might win one. Either team could win both. I think they'll be very tight games. And, yeah, Cerezo do have big game players. Kiyotaki is back. I mentioned Inoue. I guess that's the kind of thing he has been brought in to do. But, yes, it's not been a good season for them in the league. They've made a big blunder with the coaching change. Hopefully for their sake, they do kind of focus a bit on what kind of football do we want to play. Get a coach in that wants to play that kind of football. And also they have a massive gap in players. They've lots of players 21 and under, 29 and over. They really need to target, say, Tatsuki Seko, Takuro Kaneko, Hiroyuki Mai kind of players in the middle of that age range. I think if they can do that, and then they will be ready to build on whatever kind of cup success I think they might have this year.
Yeah, fair enough, Johnny. I tell you what, you want to be suggesting some more mediocre players, and maybe somebody from the Cerezo front office is listening and they might take you up. Yeah, you don't want them signing all of those players you've just suggested, or they might turn into a decent team next year. But yes, it's an Emperor's Cup quarterfinal on Wednesday night, and then the Levain Cup final on Saturday for Cerezo against Nagoya. And speaking of Grampus, they hosted the battle for third spot on Sunday afternoon, and as with Cerezo in the previous game, they started superbly and took the lead in the sixth minute as well. And Naoki Maeda started the move from deep in his own half and powered forward, continuing his run after Gabriel Xavier swept the ball out to Yuki Soma on the left, and Maeda arrived in the centre to tap in for the opener, even though Soma's square ball was slightly behind him. Just 8 minutes later, it was 2-0 after a Jakub Swiatkowski solo special. The big striker taking possession just inside the Kobe half and driving forward, twisting Ryuho Kikuchi's blood this way and that before lashing past Hiroki Ikura from just outside the D. But ultimately, Sam, Grampus have paid the price for wasting chances before the break. And on the hour, Yoshinori Muto toe-poked past Mitch Langerak after Thomas Vermaelen had headed a deep corner to the back post towards goal. And, the penalty and the long VAR deliberation that we're used to these days. Muto was brought down by Yutaka Yoshida, and what was it, 4.5 minutes of a VAR delay. Andres Iniesta smashed the penalty high into the net to earn Kobe a point.
Yeah, I mean, we're going on about these VAR things forever. It's a given that it's going to be 4 minutes or more, and I don't know why it was the most obvious penalty you'll see, but yeah, it was just it was a deserved equaliser in the end for Kobe. I thought they played very well second half. It was a very interesting tactical game. Obviously, Ficadenti wants to start deep, play on the counter, and with Xavier and Soma and Maeda, it was a really interesting front three. They dropped Mateus or rested him, probably with cup games coming up, but it worked really well in that first half. They were able to sweep forward quickly, Xavier has not played enough this season. He's a terrific player, and yeah, the ball he plays out to Sommer is fantastic, and Maeda's energy and desire to get from one end of the pitch to the other is fantastic. And yeah, they looked really good that first half. Maybe if they'd have put it away at 3-0, they had a very good chance, but didn't do so. And then second half, he just kind of went into his shell. They made changes after about 5 or 6 minutes into that second half. They brought off the likes of Maeda and Xavier and kind of put more workhorses, I'd say, would be the way to describe them. Kind of Morishita came on, Kakitani comes on, okay, like Kanazaki, but yeah, he works hard. But the guile and the creativity kind of was missing in the team, and they just sat back. And you invite a team like Kobe onto you, they've got so many good attacking players, they're eventually going to cut through you. And they did that in the end, I suppose. But the first goal they concede, just, I know I'm ranting a lot to start this podcast, but it was the same as they did against Pohang last week in the ACL. They just can't deal with a corner. It just went through them. So I think it's very good from Kobe. They've obviously looked at the way that Nagoya set up from a corner in this kind of this zonal marking system where, and they have Yoshida kind of marking on the edge of the area, and he was there to pick up Vermaelen, who's the one who heads it forward. But because Kobe surrounded Yoshida with players that ran into him, like Sakai kind of runs into Yoshida, he leaves Vermaelen completely unmarked, and then nobody's picking up anyone. So Muto just hangs back around the back of everyone, ball goes through and he pokes it in. So it's really poor defending and the way they set up Nagoya there, which you wouldn't expect from a Figueirense team to set up so poorly, but Kobe worked it really well to get back into it. And then there should have only been one winner. There wasn't in the end, but Kobe, I thought, played really well. Muto has been fantastic since signing. The energy he does, he looks a completely different player to the one that was seen in the Premier League. He's full of confidence now, and Iniesta as well. I mean, we maybe don't mention him as much as we should on this podcast, but Iniesta in this game was magnificent. Some of the passes, the ball through to Bojan, which he missed. There was a cross in for Muto, where he headed and Langrak saved onto the bar. So he definitely deserved his goal in the end. I thought, yeah, good performance from Kobe, but it is one that got away from Nagoya from the position they were in.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's it. That's, well, a point well made, Sam. But, yeah, Johnny, I mean, the Grampus, they'll be left to rue, I guess, their decisions. That maybe their substitutions, obviously, they didn't work out as well as Figueirense would have hoped. And then, with the Kobe targeting the way that Grampus defend from set pieces is really interesting as well. But, yeah, I mean, at 2-1 in this game, with Grampus had a golden opportunity to put it away when Hiroki Ikura made a point-blank save from Yoichiro Kakitani, and the leading scorer, Sho Inagaki, who's been so reliable this season, blasted over from 6 or 7 yards out. I mean, he's just scored so many important goals for Grampus over the course of this year, and, that was a golden opportunity. It probably wouldn't have wrapped the game up, but it would have restored Grampus's two-goal advantage, and that's one that he'll be left to rue. And I guess it's obviously as you were then, between those two in the battle for third, and Kobe able to maintain their 3-point advantage over Grampus after this fight back.
Yeah, it's the thin margins, isn't it? Because you talked about Figueirense's substitutions. We wouldn't be talking about that if Inagaki had put the ball on the net, because, I mean, technically Kobe could have come back and got a 3-3, but it would be less likely if they got that extra goal. I think you're always in that kind of position, though, aren't you? Like, a big game like that, Nagoya would not have been expecting in their wildest dreams to be 2-0 up so early. So is it stick or twist? I think Figueirense is obviously the kind of the defensive style coach. He's going to sit back, and I wonder, obviously, Sam, you're a big fan of like Maruyama. I wonder where his sort of leadership might be lost in a big game like that. I think, though, that it's a vital, vital point for Kobe, because I was kind of having a look at the run-ins. There's 5 games to go, and they seem to have the easiest run-in out of the sort of Kobe, Grampus and Urawa. They still have to play 3 teams in the relegation zone. So they obviously had the bit between their teeth. They really, really needed to get that. Well, once they got the first goal, then getting the second one. I think stopping Nagoya from winning is almost as important as just getting the point themselves. So although they might, I think Kikuchi's been great for them this season, but I think, Ben, you mentioned, obviously, he got given a bit of a run-around by Svierchuk. I kind of wrote in my notes, could Ikura have done a bit better with that second goal? But I might be being a bit tough on him. But yeah, I think from that start, Kobe will be delighted to get there. And I think Nagoya now, they'd probably better focus in their options on the Emperor's Cup, because Kawasaki are still in the Emperor's Cup, but Kobe and Kobe and Marinos are out. So obviously winning the Emperor's Cup may be their best route back into the ACL, if that is even what they want to do next season.
Yep, that's right, Johnny. And I'll tell you what, Sam, it's much harder for me to talk about how well the Yoshinori Muto's playing at Kobe than it is to give a Toru Aniki credit. Yeah, that's definitely one that got away with Muto excelling since he's joined Vissel. And I would maybe slightly argue your point about the Muto that was seen in the Premier League, because he wasn't ever really seen for Newcastle, was he? But yeah, we heard rumours that he was at least training with them, but we did not see much of him at all.
He turned up at Old Trafford once. That's the only time we played. He seemed to play score twice against
That's him. True, actually. Yeah, that is a memory for him, I'm sure. Yes, most definitely, and another one that you want to forget. But anyway, so yes, that result, it did keep the status quo and the three-point lead for Kobe over Grampus, but it meant that the wins earned by Urawa on Friday night and Kashima on Saturday afternoon, tightened up the battle for third gain. Reds moved a point above Grampus in the live table with a 5-1 shellacking of Kashiwa at Saitama Stadium, but ended the match day behind Nagoya on goal difference, also 3 points adrift of Vissel, while the Antlers are 5 points off third after winning 2-1 at FC Tokyo. So at Saitama Stadium on Friday night, Koya Yuriki bagged a tremendous 8-minute brace either side of Takahiro Sekine's penalty to put Reds in cruise control 3-0 up after 23 minutes. And though Mateus Savio pulled a goal back for Raisel with a superb header just past the half hour, Kasper Juncker restored their 3-goal cushion with a composed finish on the counter on the stroke of half time. And Ataro Esaka put the icing on the cake against his former team with a deflected volley past Kim Sung-yu just before the hour. So, Johnny, Sam and I have given up, trying to predict how Reds are going to do on a week-to-week basis. They've obviously had games this season where they've looked absolutely tremendous, but they've come off a spell of two games in a row where they didn't win and they didn't look particularly up to much. But this is the one that their home fans will savour, and it obviously keeps them well and truly, although they would have been anyway, in the hunt for that third spot. And at this stage, it really is anybody's, isn't it?
Yeah, I was actually disappointed a couple of weeks ago because you had Scott McIntyre on the pod and he mentioned the Urawa Gamba game. And I was really hoping he was going to say Urawa were going to beat Gamba easily, because whenever someone said that in the pod this year, they haven't done the business. But we managed to escape with a 1-1. But I think Urawa actually, despite drawing 1-1 with Gamba, I think they played very well, like especially their attacking play. Yuriki is someone I didn't think really had it until this year, but he's really come on leaps and bounds under Rodriguez. It was interesting to note also, like you mentioned, Esaka got the fifth goal. Kind of usually, like J1 or J League etiquette, when you score against your former team, you don't really celebrate. He didn't hold much back for what was a pretty inconsequential goal. So I don't know what that says about Kashima. But yeah, I think Urawa, they've obviously made a few changes in the summer, like with Schultz and Hirano, Hiroki Sakai's come in. I noticed again from last week against Gamba that they seem to be a bit too easy to counter. But I think that will come right once the players get used to the system and they've had the full kind of off-season. I think Kasper Juncker has become such an important player really quickly for them. Like last week when he wasn't in the side against Gamba, I was delighted. I couldn't believe my luck. And then he's back and then they've got five goals. I think also Sam mentioned last week about Esaka and Koizumi, because last week Juncker was missing and then Akimoto got injured, so they had Esaka up front and Koizumi just behind. And to me, they just look like the same player. So I think that they're pretty well set defensively for next year, but how they work the pieces they've got into a cohesive unit in attack, I think will be very interesting to see. And as Sam, you sort of cut Marinos apart, the kind of issues there. I think I was wondering, your kind of thoughts, like Urawa, can they genuinely challenge? Like, there could be an opening there. Kawasaki lose more players, Marinos lose more players. There's a bit of instability. A team like Urawa, who seem to be really on the up, do you expect them to be like right up there challenging next season?
Well, I better watch what I say here, because last time I predicted Urawa to win the league, they close to relegation, and Ryan still wasn't very happy with me, so I won't go that far. They've definitely got the players. I think they still need maybe two or three more in that first 11 to really be the complete package. There are signs, and this game is one of them, where things can click really well and they look like a terrific team. But yeah, there are defensive issues still. I think they are, as you said quite rightly, they are very easy to counter against. It's that transition that maybe still takes a little bit of time, because I still think central midfield, although Shibato and Hirano are decent, solid players, I don't think they're necessarily players that are going to win you the league. So I think they might need still a couple in there. So you're going to then have to get used to the system a little bit more. So next season, I expect them to be a firmer challenge for the ACL and maybe an outside bet for the title. But I still think this is a process that might take next season and then the season afterwards before we really see them. I know that preaching patience is not necessarily something that anyone else agrees with, but yeah, I think you can see that there is things going right for Rodriguez. There are many occasions where it looks terrible and it goes horrifically wrong, but yeah, keep working with it. I think they will be there or thereabouts in two seasons' time. I won't go as far as title challenges next year.
Yeah, I'll throw my two cents in. Yeah, I think they're actually pretty well set up to give it a real crack next year. It will depend a lot on what happens with the current top two, and I'm not sure if Kawasaki are going to be pillaged too much this off season. Obviously, there could be a move for Leandro Damião from abroad, and if that happens, then that will obviously leave another massive hole. But otherwise, yeah, I'd expect Kawasaki to obviously be just clicking along as they're want to do. But yeah, for me, yeah, well, where Reds are, I think we'd all agree they're ahead of schedule, and ultimately at the end of the day, whether they finish sixth or higher, I don't think there's any chance of them finishing below sixth, is there? I think that is above what we would have expected, and even the most optimistic of Red supporters would have expected. So yeah, for me, the top three is a very legitimate goal this season, and next season it should be the absolute minimum for a side with the resources that they've clearly been able to throw at the squad in the summer. And if they can add a couple more, I'm becoming quite a big fan of Atsuki Ito in central midfield, although he didn't play on Friday night. I think. I think I do want to jinx Reds, because I don't really like them very much. But yeah, they are.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, they are. To me, honestly, yeah, they are shaping up very, very nicely indeed. But we'll wait and see there. And I'm no responsibility taken if I have indeed jinxed their slide down the table in 2022. To the other game then, involving a real top three challenger. Kashima are still hanging on. They're, as I said, 5 points adrift of third place Kobe after their win at FC Tokyo on Saturday afternoon. Antlers took the lead in first half stoppage time when Arthur Kaike headed in a deep free kick from Diego Pachuca at Tokyo stand-in keeper Tsuyoshi Kodama's near post. Kodama just stood there and watched the ball flash in past him. And 20 minutes into the second half, it was 2-0 when ISA Wada had all the time in the world to pick his spot after his first attempt from Sean Madoy's cutback was blocked. Tokyo made things somewhat interesting when substitute Ryoma Watanabe, who came on for an injured Diego Oliveira just past the half hour, volleyed in Takumi Nakamura's cross with 15 minutes left. But yes, once again, the less said about FC Tokyo, the better. And here we are again, Sam. I'm going to come to you. on Antlers. They didn't have much to beat on Saturday, and they've taken care of business. But for me personally, I think 5 points with five to play, considering, as we've said, the Kobe's relatively easy looking fixture list. Although they've obviously been known to things have been known to blow up in their face over the years. But yeah, with the traffic they have to climb over and the 5 point gap, I don't quite think they're going to make it, which means that all their eggs will be in the Emperor's Cup basket on Wednesday night when they travel to Kawasaki.
Well, I suppose with the Emperor's Cup, they've got two shots at it, because if they beat Kawasaki, then they can go on win the Emperor's Cup and get into the ACL. If they lose to Kawasaki, they'll be rooting for them to go on and win it and try and nick themselves into fourth place and then get in the Emperor's Cup that way. So it's still quite open. I know there's a decent gap to Kobe, but I still think those three teams, if they're not going to, behind Kobe, if they're not going to go for get third, fourth place is still a viable option, and I don't think many people would try and back against Kawasaki winning the Emperor's Cup. So it's definitely open, and we're still going to have an interesting end to the season. But yeah, as far as third place has gone, I think that's too much for them. They're too inconsistent. I think there are good players there, I've said all season. They should be doing, in my opinion, a bit better than this. I think they should be, with the quality of players in that squad, I think they should be firmly in that top three. And yeah, just haven't for whatever reason. I think Everaldo not turning up this season is perhaps the main reason for that. But yeah, just this is a decent enough performance. Yeah, Tokyo didn't put up too much of a fight. I mean, the Arthur Kaike headed goal probably summed up Tokyo's approach to the game, very loosely marking him. The only positive I'd have for Tokyo, I thought Watanabe, he's been injured for a lot of this season, but since he's come back, I've been really impressed with him. And there are good signs there. So I think next season you might have a decent player on your hands if he can stay fit.
Well, yeah, fingers crossed, hopefully, and we'll wait and see on that. But yeah, Tokyo were still in a mid-table mediocrity in ninth. But yeah, Johnny, what do you think about Antlers overall, considering the fact that Everaldo has been a complete non-factor? Obviously, him and Ilunga were the standout forwards in the league last season, and I guess the fact that they've got next to nothing at all from him all year, and they're still in the still well and truly in the hunt for third place, and yeah, still in the Emperor's Cup, and as Sam says, they could possibly still make it into next year's ACL if they finish fourth. And either Frontale or Nagoya, if they get up to third, win the cup themselves. So, I don't know, as they sit here with five games to go, I guess if you had have told an Antlers fan at the start of the season, you know, Everaldo is not going to score any league goals for you at all, but you'll be sixth with five games to go, do you reckon they might have taken that?
I guess if you told them that, they'd probably have guessed they'd sign someone else instead. But so I'm not quite sure. But I think you both made really good points. Like Sam said about like just the inconsistency, because in the last seven games are win loss win loss win loss win, and the last four games were either 1-2-1 or lost 2-1. So I mean, there is some sort of consistency there, I guess, but not really the kind Kashima fans would want. And then you've kind of got the danger of, like you both said, about Everaldo just hasn't turned up. So he hasn't turned up, but other young, sellable assets to Europe have turned up in the shape of, what, is that 13 goals for Ueda and being at the Olympics? And then I think he went to Ryotaro Araki's got 9 goals. And I believe, if I got this right, if he gets 10 goals, he'll be the first teenager to score at double digits for Kashima for like 24 years or something. So yeah, those two deserve like tremendous credit for how they've done in attack. But yeah, there's good players, and there's players that are just not consistent enough. And together, it's six. They're where they should be. Really, they've got decent players, enough to be in the top six, but not enough to realistically be in that top three. But what I wanted to kind of ask you guys about, and this can kind of link maybe Kashima and Tokyo and a few other teams. Because obviously they got rid of Zago earlier in the year and brought in Naoki Soma, and they haven't really improved at all. And it's going to be quite interesting, I think, in the off-season, because obviously both Osaka clubs are looking for new coaches. And you could even have like Kashiwa, Tokyo and Hiroshima might also be in the market for new coaches too. Do you feel like Soma, and maybe to an extent what happened at Seveso, that should serve as a warning for teams like looking for like quick fixes where... Well, there might not necessarily be quick fixes there. I mean, what would you say to that, Sam?
Well, I suppose Kawasaki looked inward and found Toro Aniki. So there are I think Kashima did it as well with Go Oiwa, and he did very well and won a Champions League as well. It just seems to be the go-to for any team across Japan when they sack a manager. They don't really look too hard. They just think, oh, who's next in line? He'll do. Maybe he'll be great. Maybe he'll be terrible. So, yeah, I hate that whole entire practice. I think you should do a lot more work to try and find your new manager. But it just seems that sort of thing is kind of set in stone in Japan. So we have to deal with it. But yeah, I really would encourage every team to properly search out a manager. It looks like Gamba Osaka are doing that eventually, but it usually just goes that way of, we'll try someone within us. If it doesn't work, then we'll do the work. But it's just, yeah, it seems to be lazy option first.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would just, if I was, leading the managerial search for FC Tokyo, I would just go straight to Toru Aniki's number two and say, hey, do you fancy stepping up into the big time? Because, he's obviously, he will have had, I don't even know the fella's name, but he would have had a lot of, time working under Aniki, and learning at the feet of him is a terrific education. And, I want to see Tokyo playing better football first and foremost. So, yeah, from my personal perspective, I'd quite like to, raid the enemy and, see if their number two wouldn't mind a crack at a top job, because, as I say, that's the first thing I want to see. I want to be entertained by my club, and there's no doubt that over the last 5 or 6 years, the last decade or so or more, Frontale have been the real entertainers of J1. So, it's often infuriating for supporters, as they're not really shown the workings of how clubs go about approaching managers, and obviously a number of clubs will have to deal with over the off season, and we might be coming on to talk about your club and their managerial search very, very shortly, Johnny. So basically, we've wrapped up the hunt for the top three. Just before we take a quick break, we'll wrap up the top six. Then we've mentioned already that Frontale are 12 points ahead of Yokohama F. Marinos. Kawasaki have 84 points, and Yokohama F. Marinos 72. Then Kobe are currently third on 61, and Nagoya and Reds both have 58, and Kashima have 56. So we're halfway through the match day 33 slate. When we come back, we'll round up the other five games. Okay, welcome back, and we'll segue on to the relegation dogfight as Gamba Osaka's opponents on a Saturday evening, Tosu, aren't mathematically out of the race for third, but for all intents and purposes, their goose is cooked. Johnny, we'd been worried that Gamba might have been sucked down into the abyss with your side in patchy form, to say the least, and some of the relegation zone occupants bubbling up under the surface, but you will have been very relieved to see Takashi Usami settle Gamba nerves with a fine trap and a classy finish in off Park Ilgu's far post in just the 10th minute. His fifth of the season, and as the J-League Facebook page told me, Gamba's 1,700th J1 goal, the first side to reach that milestone. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I think the one goal on Saturday was much more important in that context than the 1,700, but it was great to see Gamba actually scoring a goal from a quick counter-attack rather than the usual being countered by opposition, which I think happened the last time I was on. Shoma Doi ran like unchallenged from inside his own half. And I think Sam had his chance to talk about Oshima earlier, so I'll take my chance to talk about Usami, because you mentioned like five goals. It's not that many, but four of those five goals have been winners in games. He scored the only goal in both games against Tosu, and the other goal, he's got a goal and an assist against Kashio in a 2-1 win. So he's almost a bit like Kazuma Watanabe, who I really wish we hadn't sold to Yokohama FC at the end of last season. He's not scored a ton of goals, but every time he does score a goal, it is vital. So, I think Tosu were everything Gamba hoped they would be on Saturday, a team that don't have a whole lot to play for. I think, like, compared to Urawa the week before, there was a kind of downing of intensity, if for want of a better word. And, Gamba really took advantage of it.
And, Sam, I mean, as we've spoken about in recent episodes, I mean, you can't say that Tosu have downed tools, because obviously they've been ravaged in the summer, losing lots of players. And, the fact that they're still up in seventh is an absolute credit to everyone that's basically remained at the club, especially when you factor in all the Kim Myung-hui stuff as well. As Johnny says, they were probably the right opponent at the right time for Gamba on on Saturday. And I mean, yeah, Osami, I mean, it could have even been better for him, couldn't it, Sam? I mean, he thrashed a 30-yard drive just wide 10 minutes after scoring, and then 10 minutes into the second half, he blasted over. So he was well and truly in the mood, and it could have been even more comfortable for Gumba had his range been slightly better on those couple of chances.
Yeah, I think it looked good that he was confident as soon as he got that goal. It was a really well-taken goal from a good build-up. The first touch is sublime and then, yeah, a fine finish. And he did look like he'd gained a few steps after that and was keen to have a go on goal. And, yeah, looked closer to the Osami that we all know and Johnny loves. So I agree with you completely that Sagan have not just down tools, but this season I think has just caught up with them. They've run their race maybe a few weeks ago now, and they just didn't really get going, I didn't think. But Gamba, I think you've got to give them credit. They controlled the game. They were not necessarily creating masses of chances, but most of the chances did go to them. And yeah, it was a professional performance. It was, yeah, just disappointing for Sagan, but again, credit to them for the season. And Johnny, I think you've got some news for us on Gamba's potential new manager. I just want to, something I noticed in that news when it was released on Twitter was a little bit of people thinking, why haven't we gone for Kim Jong-hui? And I'm just wondering, would you have wanted him pre his various issues at the moment? Would he have been a good fit? And would you still take him given what has gone on behind the scenes?
So if I go to the Kim Myung-hui first, I think naturally, like, you tend to look Tosu 7th in the league, Oita 18th, with not vastly different budgets. I think Tosu have a much better youth system. I think when Miyamoto was let go, Kim Myung-hui was a popular choice from Gamba fans. But it's difficult to talk about the power harassment allegations, but if those are, or some of those are proven to be true, he's not going to come to Gamba. It's just not going to happen. I think he may go the way of like Cho Kwee-jae, and he takes a bit of time out of the game and comes back at a lower level and perhaps takes that chance to rehabilitate himself. But I think from what I can understand from the article and sort of Japanese Gamba fans I've talked to today, the Katunosaka deal is just about done. I don't think he's actually signed, but Gamba want him and he wants to come to Gamba. And having been like Kenta Hasegawa's assistant in 2014 and 2015, I mean, anyone associated with that Gamba treble winning side in 2014 is going to be welcome with open arms at Gamba. And yeah, it's quite interesting to know actually what's going on this season, because obviously Matsunami has been in charge of things, and they brought in a few weeks ago Takashi Kiyama, the former Sendai and multiple J2 team coach. And it seems like in the last couple of games, from what's come out from fans, Kiyama is doing all the work on training. And also a friend of a friend I know was at the game on Saturday, and Kiyama was giving all the instructions. So I think when you had Scott McIntyre on a few weeks back, he was talking about the gap between like Postecoglou being at Marinos and Muscat coming in, and he had a caretaker coach, but he said he was essentially a figurehead while the Australian coaches worked in the background. It seems like Matsunami is now he's just a figurehead. He does the media work, and Kiyama is basically coaching the team. I don't know who actually picks the team, but I think Haruto Shirai has come in the last couple of weeks. Players like Shinji Yajima have dropped out, so there's been subtle changes. And also, you notice on Saturday they had the starting 11. All those players were there last season. And maybe if you brought in Onose for Yuya Fukuda, and obviously Miura and Shoji were injured, if you brought one of them in for Suganuma, it's basically the starting 11 that finished second last year. So I think Kiyama's really taking Gamba back to basics. What is interesting, though, is he's playing 4-4-2, whereas Katanosaka is playing 3-4-2-1 at Oita for as long as I've known. And Gamba obviously have the three great centre-backs, Shoji, Kim and Miura, when they're fit. But next year, when Yamami comes in, you have Yamami, Wellington Silva, Usami. It's more set up for a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1. So it'd be interesting to see if that is what happens. But as a Gamba fan, I'm quite happy that someone with experience, someone with a plan, someone who will have learned a lot of things moving up from J3 to J1. It actually made me feel good about things for the first time in a long time supporting Gamba. What about you, Sam? I know like people just look at the league table and think, well, why are Gamba taking someone from 18th? But do you think Katanosaka would he be a good appointment, or how do you feel about that?
It's interesting because that Oita season, that they were so impressive when they first came up, and yeah, it was a different style of football. Teams didn't really work them out, and they were so high in the table, and it was very easy on the eye, and you can see why it would be an attractive proposition. My worry would be, have teams figured out that way of playing, and if it just brings it into Gamba, is it going to be figured out, or do Gamba have the players to play that system and to play it very, very well? You mentioned the three centre-backs. On paper, those three should be a fantastic back three. We haven't quite seen it as often as Gamba supporters would have liked. So that'd be interesting. I mean, he's not really got the players to work with at Oita. That team isn't very good. So you can't necessarily just judge him on how this Oita team is performing, because I think they're performing as they should be. It's not really necessarily any increase on that, but maybe with a better set of players, yeah, it would work. I think he'll get the, as you mentioned here, being affiliated to the club and being part of that 2014 staff, it'll buy him some time, and they'll allow him to get his thoughts across. So I do agree with you in terms of having a man with a plan and just going, because Matsunami came in, it was a bit all over the place, and it's kind of been reined in with Kihama, which is a good thing. So it's an interesting appointment. It's not necessarily who I would have thought as like the prime candidate for it. But yeah, I think it could work. I think you'll be a lot more stable, at least, than this season.
Yeah, I think another point one of my Japanese friends made is that the amount of injuries Gamba have had in the last couple of years, that they're probably going to look for a physical coach too. And I think Oita's physical coach, I believe his name is Jun Sato, is apparently very highly regarded in the Japanese game. So he may come with Kato Nosaka, and jokes about Shun Nagasawa making a return to Gamba's side. I don't know if too many of the Oita squad would necessarily come. So maybe Kato Nosaka and his physical coach coming. And I mean, realistically, the Gamba squad, if you look at it on paper, it doesn't need too many additions. You've already got Yamami coming in, and there's Jiro Nakamura and Issa Sakamoto are being promoted to the top team. They're both kind of heavily involved in Japanese youth teams. It doesn't need too much done to it. I think not massive surgery. So, yeah, if he could come in with his ideas, get players like Wellington Silva up to speed without the injuries and coming into the country late. Leandro Pereira apparently has a 2-year contract. If we could find some system that incorporates him rather than the players just expecting it to be Patrick standing at the penalty spot waiting for headers. Yes, someone with a plan is really what Gamba have been crying out for most of this year, I think.
Well, yeah, it's a really interesting appointment, Johnny. And just before we move off it, I mean, yeah, your overall, I guess your impression when you first heard the rumour, were you hoping that Gamba might go for, well, to put it bluntly, a bigger name? I mean, we know Kato Nosaka has had, success at Trinita, and he's well and truly established himself in J1 coaching circles. And, having worked for Gamba in the past, I guess, can be a blessing and a curse. He's definitely familiar to everyone at the Suita City Stadium. To put it bluntly, yeah, did you think you would be getting a bigger name and going for a bigger name and hopefully landing one? Or are you perfectly happy with Kato Nosaka and, yeah, looking forward to the football that he might be putting on for you next year?
It's actually a very interesting question, Ben, because on Saturday night I read an article saying that, I think it's Lozano, who was the Mexico under-23 coach at the Olympics, has been offered a contract by a J1 club. So I sent a message to my friend just before going to bed. Do you think Gamba could be that club? And then when I got the message back at lunchtime on Sunday, obviously that the news had come out about Kato Nosaka. So I actually, yeah, I felt good, and I think I messaged you saying I made an impulse buy of a visitor's seat ticket for Marinos against Gamba next Wednesday, because I was feeling a bit good about like Kiyama coming in and making some changes, and then Kato Nosaka is going to come in, and there was obviously the win. There was a bit of a feel-good factor. Not feel-good factor is probably too strong, but it's been so dire, or the fear of going down has been hanging over like the sword of Damocles for so long this season. It finally feels that there's a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. So, yeah, he's not the biggest name, but that being the biggest name doesn't necessarily mean he's going to succeed. You see people like Nelsinho or Kulpi, they're big names in the Japanese game, but they didn't succeed. So, yeah, I'm more than happy to give him a shot.
All right, terrific stuff then. So, yeah, on Saturday then, a first win in three. And, well, yeah, with Kashiwa taking such a big goal difference hit on Friday night, Johnny, it means you're above them now and up to 13th, 7 points clear of 17th place to Tokushima, as we'll come on to most of the other results went for you. So a pretty satisfactory weekend and, yeah, a confidence boost, a feel-good factor returning to the Suita City Stadium ahead of a big-time game at home to Urawa in the Empress Cup on Wednesday night.
Yeah, so we've seen them a bit recently. Obviously, they gave us a really tough game away from home. We've had all of our games so far in the Emperor's Cup have been at home, and we've done pretty well. It's a one-off game. It could go either way. I think Kim Young-Gwon and Ryu Takao both left the field in a stretcher on Saturday. Takao, I think, might have been cramping. He was just using the stretcher to waste a bit of time, whereas Kim was in the wars. But with Kiyama coming in, because obviously Suganuma and Sato started the away game against Urawa, and I think that was comfortably Sato's best performance for Gamba. Yes, it's a one-off. Like I say, Urawa can be countered. What kind of team will they put out? What kind of team will Gamba put out? Yeah, I'm looking forward to it much more than I was looking forward to the league game about 10 days ago.
Fair enough then. All right, so yeah, Gumbo, we're not quite calling them safe, and obviously they're not mathematically safe yet, but yeah, moving up to 13th above Raysol means they're in a far better position than they were at this time last week. So from 13th placed Gumbo, we'll head down to the foot of the table, and in a vital game at the Yurtec Stadium, Vegalta Sendai hosted Sanfrecce Hiroshima, and hosts Vegalta look to arrest their recent horror run that had seen them slip to the foot of the table, and they made a terrific start when the veteran Kunimitsu Sekiguchi fired in a lovely first-time shot from inside the D in the 10th minute. A lot of teams scoring in around the same time early on in the games in this particular match day. But their hearts were in their mouths with 14 minutes left when Jakub Slovic got a hand to Yuki Nogami's deflected cross, and the loose ball basically hit Shunki Higashi inside the six-yard box but didn't trickle over the line and was hacked clear. So Vegalta supporters were able to rest easy for a few minutes, and then deep into stoppage time, Ryoma Kida made the points safe when he worked a yard of space and lashed in his first Sendai goal in the 94th minute. A first win in seemingly eons for Vegalta, Sam, and it saw them haul themselves back off the foot of the table one weekend after slipping into the cellar. As we'll come on to next, Shonan won and are now out of the drop zone, so Vegalta are still 5 points behind them. So again, it's all to play for. Sendai don't have the next two look really tough with the Kobe and Nagoya on the slate, but then they've got a six-pointer against Belmare to play. So, I mean, it's still in their hands. They're, they've only won five times all season, but when they simply had to win at home on Saturday, they got the job done.
Yeah, they did, amazingly so, but they were pretty decent. They rode their luck, as you mentioned, with the Higashi chance there. There was another one where the ball dropped to Higashi and he had, the freedom of the penalty area, but volleyed over the bar. So there were plenty of chances that Hiroshima probably should have taken, and maybe if they had anything to play for, they might have been a bit more switched on and taken some of them. But you've got to give credit to Vegalta. I think he brought in Keiman Togashi in the summer. He didn't really play a lot for Nagasaki this season, but was a favourite of Tegumori when he was at Nagasaki, and he's played very well. He's had a couple of injuries, but otherwise, yeah, I think against Gamba, I thought it was perhaps his best performance. But yeah, up front here, I mean, he is a bit of a target man, is a bit of a hold-up player. He worked it really well to Sekiguchi for this first goal and really occupied the defenders, and they had a difficult time of it, Hiroshima, at the back. And maybe, yeah, again, there was a lot of criticism coming for Hiroshima to that I was seeing. Not really focused, Jovaku out and all this sort of thing. They weren't playing very well, but you've got to give credit to Sendai. They were up at it. It's kind of one, obviously they had to win. They had no choice about it. And they went and they kept going. They scored a couple of decent goals. I think it's still too late for them, those next two fixtures. You couldn't ask for two worse fixtures, really, than Kobe and Nagoya. But every time we write anyone off in this league, they then go on and win. So great for Fagata, great for a bit of an interesting relegation dogfight, so I'm all for it.
Well, that's it, Johnny. Yes, the J-Talk curses have struck again. Yeah, basically, yeah, literally a week after Sam and I had basically written Vigalta off, then, yes, they went and won this game. So whether that's just a false dawn or whether they're actually going to haul themselves out of a pretty sizable hole, I guess remains to be seen, but they've at least given themselves a fighting chance after this result.
I think the curse extends to my blog too, because I slagged off Kamen Togashi when he signed for Sendai, saying he was a forward who doesn't score, and then he's obviously rubbed my face right in it. But I think, yeah, as you kind of hinted at, I think Sam Fritchie were the right team to play, a bit like Gamba against Tosu. Like if you want it, you don't want to be playing teams like Nagoya and Kobe who are going for third. You want to be playing a team comfortably in 10th that nothing to play for. So I kind of tend to agree with you too, though. I think they've got three of the last five games are against teams in that train, like challenging for third. I was looking through all the fixtures like earlier, giving myself a headache. You can always make a reason for each team to win each individual fixture, but then no one's going to be consistent enough. Like, is anyone going to take more than 10 points from like the last five games? I kind of doubt it. And Sendai could scrape their way out. I think it's more likely that they don't. But you're kind of maybe turning a bit to Hiroshima, because you mentioned like Joe Fuku's come in for a lot of criticism. But I mean, I kind of wonder like how much of it is him and how much of it is the lack of money or resources? Because it's interesting that he wasn't playing in this game, but they brought in Tsukasa Shiotani. So, I mean, are they going to go back to playing a back four with Nogami at right back and Sasaki at left back? Because otherwise that leaves them with six very good centre-backs and little to no depth elsewhere. And if it's Joe Fuku has said, I really want Shiotani, he's the man to come in and we'll put him in midfield in place of Kawabe, then, yeah, Joe Fuku is the problem at Hiroshima. But if it's someone else or there's other forces at work within the club, just replacing Joe Fuku, I mean, you could potentially move up a couple of places next season. But over the course of a number of years, is a new coach really going to move them on from what he's done? I mean, how do you feel about Joe Fuku, Sam, and also the move for Shiotani? Did that strike you as a bit strange too?
It is a bit strange considering they have no money, we were led to believe, and Shiotani just been coming out of the UAE. I'm sure he's requiring a decent sum of money to come back. And yeah, it's a weird one as well, because they tried the four at the back at the start of the season, and it was awful. They just didn't get to grips with it at all. They're a lot more comfortable in a back three. And they've been, before this game, their games, they've been playing quite well, actually. You know, beat Nagoya the game before, beat Sapporo, sorry. So when it does work in that system, I think it's decent enough. I don't think Joe Fuku with this squad is going to go much higher than a mid-table finish, but, I mean, he's solid enough. I mean, but maybe, you know, probably quite rightly, Hiroshima would want more than that, but he has been hamstrung. They only signed Junior Santos in the winter, and he's not really performed anywhere near how we would have expected him to, considering his performances at Yokohama F. Marinos last season. So I think, given the squad, maybe he's done as expected with it, and I don't know if anyone else could get too much more out of them, but maybe it just needs a complete freshening up, and maybe that's the way that Hiroshima want to go, and go completely away from this system, which, I mean, but it's kind of an ingrained system as well, this 3-6-1, which they've been playing it forever. That's how they won titles. It's just kind of the Hiroshima DNA, and it's going to be a bit like Urawa after Petrovic left, I think, because he has such a way of playing, and it's taken them so long to get away from that. They always kept trying things, it didn't work, and going back to the way that they were playing. So I think they may be in that sort of situation and might need to go for someone like a Rodriguez, a completely different system, and then just settle on that. So maybe that's what Hiroshima need to go for, and they need to have a clean break away from it, because they are a long way away from being title contenders.
Yeah, most definitely. All right, very interesting stuff there, guys. And I tell you what, if they're going to bring Shiotani back, they might as well take Yojiro Takahagi off for FC Tokyo and reunite the entire title-winning squad from the middle of the last decade. They're probably welcome to Takahagi for next season. But, yeah, Shiotani, definitely a blast from the past for J-League watchers. All right, well, I think Sendai's win did take a few of us by surprise. And, yes, it hauled them off the the foot of the table. The two huge relegation six-pointers that we pumped up on last week's episode, they did not disappoint, at least in terms of drama. We can chat with the guys whether they delivered much in terms of quality or not. But yes, replacing Vegalta at the foot of the table once again are Yokohama FC, whose recent surge was halted in a Kanagawa derby away at Shonan, though it did look like the good times were going to continue to roll for the visitors when J-Talk favourite Yusuke Matsuo gave them a spectacular lead in the 63rd minute. He blocked an attempted ball upfield from Hirokazu Ishihara about 45 yards out and stormed in on goal, finally rolling a cool finish past Kosei Tani. Matsuo most definitely is back and banging these days. But Belmare turned it around in the last 15 minutes and pulled themselves out of the bottom four when firstly Yuki Ohashi dinked a neat finish over Sven de Brodersen in the 78th minute, and then Naoki Yamada backheaded a bouncing ball in from 2 yards out with a minute left after Shuto Machino had headed a corner on target. So, yeah, wild scenes on the terraces at the Lemon Gas Stadium. A first win in 7 for Belmare and a first win for caretaker manager Satoshi Yamaguchi. So, Sam, I think we've said a number of times in recent weeks that, yeah, Belmare hadn't been getting the results they necessarily deserved, and whether they actually did deserve to win this game or not, they were probably due a little bit of good fortune and a rub of the green, and yes, they've claimed a vital victory for themselves here.
Well, it definitely deserves a little bit of fortune. It maybe needs to go to Okamoto more than anyone else. He's using the brunt of it, but yeah, this was a tense game, as you can imagine, a relegation battle. Yokohama FC didn't play with the freedom that they maybe have done against tougher opposition in Kashima and Yokohama and everyone else that they've played and beaten. They were a little bit more tentative, and that kind of played into Shonan Sands, especially when they went a goal up Yokohama. They dropped a bit too deep. Shonan are going to whip crosses in. They did that. Wellington will always cause problems, and he did that. And Yokohama weren't quite as organised as they should be. The ball did bounce quite kindly for them for the first goal. Shonan, that's maybe the break that they needed. And Machino, finished quite well. And then, yeah, turning in a corner. So it was it's a huge victory for Shonan and a devastating one for Yokohama, because they were in great form, Yokohama, but they had to kind of win every game. And I think I'm going to rule another team out again, so that means they'll win expensive. Yeah, they're in a lot of trouble now, but Shonan get themselves out of that relegation zone. It leads to Scott McIntyre. As soon as the ball at the back of the net, he was messaging me slight mockery over this, so that was good. But yeah, it was just a vital victory. I think a draw would have been probably the fair result on the balance of play. But yeah, huge for Shonan, great confidence booster, and let's see if they can take it on. But yeah, who knows? Probably they'll go and lose next week, and Yokohama will win, and we'll be back to where we started.
Yes, indeed. So obviously in recent weeks, Johnny, Sam and I have been waxing lyrical, not only about Yusuke Matsuo, but also Saulo Mineiro, who has taken a couple of different games by the scruffs of their necks. And, he was obviously one of the major threats to Shonan in this game with a couple of fierce blasts that have become his trademark. And, I mean, he could have nicked a point for Yokohama FC right at the death, but his shot was just deflected past the post with Tani scrambling across to attempt to save. So, what have you made of this brief resurrection from Yokohama FC? It's probably not going to come to anything at the end of the day, but they have certainly freshened things up after the Olympic break, and they've obviously been exciting to watch at times.
Yeah, I kind of wrote down in my notes, I think almost the worst thing that Yokohama FC can do this year in the short term anyway is get relegated and look good doing it, because I think that team's just going to get gutted, isn't it, in the winter. Like you mentioned Matsuo, there's Tatsuki Seko, I think you were talking about Takagi last week, and then you've got like Saulo Mineiro. Like any team we've said negative comments about to date in this pod, be it Marinos, Kashiwa, Hiroshima, I mean, he looks like he could go there and fit in quite well. Then you've got Brodus in the goalkeeper, Gabriel's come in and done well. I mean, they could lose six, seven, eight players just right like that if they were to go down. And yeah, they really had to win this game, because now they've got 25 points. So even if they were to win their five remaining games, they'd only get them to 40, and they're just not going to do that. So I think, yeah, like you guys, I don't want to totally rule anyone out, but I think that could be at the end of the season, you might look back at this game as, yeah, that was a game that really killed them. I think on the other hand, like, yeah, Shonan have got the best defence in the bottom half of the league, but I think their attack's one of the weaker ones. So, like, even if they do play well, the games are always tight, so they could really go either way. Yeah, and I think before I come on to talk about Tokushima Vortis, because Shonan played Tokushima at home in the second last game of the season, and then they have a potentially safe Gamba in the final game. So, yeah, with Shonan finishing bottom and not being relegated last year and getting through the playoff 2 years ago, I think I'd rather be a lucky team than a good one, and I wouldn't really want to bet against them, like, staying in the league.
Yeah, they've obviously done their survival chances a huge boost with this home win over Yokohama FC. And as we said, it has hauled them out of the drop zone and a first win in seven. And it's obviously worth noting that their goal difference, Johnny mentioned, yeah, the defence is the best in the bottom half of the league. And, yeah, their goal difference advantage is literally worth an extra point. So they are now a point above Tokushima, who drew 1-1 at home with Oita in the other huge six-pointer on Saturday. Sam used the word tense to describe the Shonan Yokohama FC game. I think that's another. This is another game we could use that adjective for, and perhaps pretty ordinary as well. But it did have some drama in the last 20 minutes after Revortis had dominated what chances there were up to the point of that point of the game. They finally took the lead with the 20 minutes left when Taisei Miyashiro lashed a half volley on the rebound after Shun Takagi had saved Kaka's header from a corner. But 10 minutes later, Trinita equalised in similar circumstances when Shun Nagasawa's shot was saved by Naoto Kamifukumoto, but Yamato Machida was on hand to blast home the loose ball. So Vortis, yet now a point behind Shonan, and Trinita are three behind Belmare, but yes, both of those teams with a ton of goal difference, basically impossible to make up on Shonan with five to play. So Johnny, yeah, this was not the easiest game on the eye, but yeah, a relegation six pointer really is, of course, and with so much on the line, I guess frustration for Tokushima for losing the lead, but Oita have at least given themselves a chance by rescuing a point here in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, you always see when two teams like this struggling to stay up when it's 1-1, it doesn't really suit either side, and especially so for the home team, as Tokushima were, and I only caught the highlights, but it seemed like they had the majority of the chances. Miyashiro coming back from injury in the last couple of games, I think that's given them a bit of a boost, and they've got Bakenga up front, but yeah, it's going to be tough for them still to stay up. Obviously, round 38, they play Hiroshima at home. So as we mentioned in the Sendai Hiroshima game, if they're still in the hunt on that final day, that is a very winnable last game of the season. So I think Poyatas really needs to keep them in the hunt. For Oita, because they're one of the lowest teams in terms of shots and goal, expected goals and things like that. But the last three games, all that's really shot up. So they're definitely fighting, but as we mentioned earlier, I think when we talked about Katano Osaka, that just that lack of quality, like Sam's favourite Nagasawa is one of the top strikers. And I would say, to more positive about them, like Yamato Machida, who scored the goal, that's seven goals this season for him. I would say, I mean, he's probably one of the biggest surprises of this season. Like, nothing much was expected from him, but I think he's done pretty well. What do you think about him, Sam?
Yeah, fantastic player. I just wish that Naoki Nomura had been fit a bit more this season, because those two are actual quality players, with Shimoda as well in behind. It was his ball that caused the issues that Oita then scored from. So there are some decent players in here, but not necessarily got them on the pitch enough at the same time. And yeah, the strike force were limited, let's say. But they got into this game. Once they went 1-0 down, they had no choice. They had to win this game. They had to go out. They had to attack. And it was the same last week when they had a home game against Vigalta. It's a game they had to win. So everything was kind of done for them. They know exactly how they have to play. And they did this. They chucked everyone. I think most forwards were on at this point in the second half. They just threw them forward. And you throw enough at it, there's going to be a mistake somewhere when you're playing the teams around you, and that's kind of what happened. They left Machida out completely unmarked, and he finished well. I think he'd be one, whether they stay up or go down, I'd think maybe a team slightly higher would look at, and maybe Shimoda as well. He came down from Kawasaki, where he didn't get much time, but had previously played quite well at Shonan. So, yeah, there are decent players there. And Enrique, I think you mentioned him maybe a few, appearances back now. I don't know how long ago that was, but he's come into that defence, and they're still, I mean, solid's not necessarily the correct word, but in terms of teams down there, he's a little bit more quality than others around them. So, yeah, they manage to keep themselves into games, and that could help them. I think the lack of strikers is going to cost them in the end, but yeah, they've got a good fighting spirit. That's good to see, and it's great for a Gamba supporter as well if their manager is there keeping them in games and keeping them fighting. But yeah, this was a really low on quality game, but tight and tense, and it seems to be the way generally when two teams desperately need a victory, they have to settle for a draw. So that's how it was. But I'd still give both teams a chance of staying. You mentioned their fixtures there. Shimizu were just outside, lost obviously to Kawasaki. Their fixture list is horrific. So you could see one or both of them trying to overhaul Shimizu. So that might be the way to go in Shonan. I don't think, obviously not completely out of it at all. So it's still really tight, but I would put it two to go down from those four. And still think Senbei and Yokohama probably have too much to do.
Yeah, all right. Well, we'll just quickly reset the situation in the bottom eight before we talk about the final game from match day 33. So, yeah, Gamba moved above Reysol on goal difference after their win on Saturday. Both of those teams have 37 points, Gamba 13th and Kashiwa 14th. And while not mathematically safe, they're 7 points clear of the drop zone with 5 games to play. Then, Shimizu, who, as Sam's just mentioned, lost to the champions-elect in the first game right back at the start of this episode. They have 32 points. Shonan moved on to 31 with their win, and Tokushima are in 17th in the drop zone on 30 points. Then Oita have 28, Vigalta Sendai 26, and Yokohama FC 25. And, we're going to obviously talk a little bit about what's coming up in match day 34, the Wednesday after this one. But just a little note about Tokushima. They'll be playing at home against Cerezo Osaka, and hopefully for them a perfect chance to bounce back from the disappointment of dropping 2 points so late on in this game. I just wonder, guys, what sort of a Cerezo Osaka side is going to turn up to the Pocari Sweat Stadium on next Wednesday after they've played this Wednesday against Nagoya in the Emperor's Cup and then in Saturday's Levain Cup final. They're obviously going to be still all drunk after winning the title, or they're going to be absolutely devastated after losing the final. So that might be a huge opportunity for Tokushima, because Cerezo are in that group of five teams in the table that basically are just playing out the string. I mean, there's the top seven down to Tosu still mathematically in the hunt for something, of course, and the bottom eight that we've just mentioned, there are five teams stuck in the middle, led by Vispa Fukuoka, then FC Tokyo, Hiroshima, Sapporo, and Cerezo Osaka. And we're going to wrap up the match day 33 slate with the game at the Sapporo Dome between Consadole and Sanfrecce Hiroshima. And Sam, they say if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. It finished 0-0, and the highlights package was one of the shortest I've ever seen on DAZN. Just edged over 4 minutes, and they were really struggling, I think. It wasn't a lot happening at all in this one, was there?
No, let's see what was nice. Sugano made a couple of very good saves. The main one from Watari when he was sent clean through. And yeah, Sugano did very well. And yeah, there we go. That was it, I think. It was a game that didn't matter, and you could tell from both sides. Neither really went forward with great urgency. Neither really got much together. Sapporo were a bit disjointed in the way they went forward. Avispa, solid enough defensively. They made a couple of changes as well. So I think there's a little bit of experimentation going on at Avispa, which is fine. They're pretty much in mid-table. You might as well give other people a chance. And yeah, it was just a friendly, really. That's how it looked like. Not a great deal of action. And DAZN did very well to find any highlights.
Yes, I would say that, yeah, from what I saw, Fukuoka definitely shaded it. But yes, they don't think there was any injustice that they left with a point after a 0-0 draw. The only 0-0 on the match day, as Sam says, basically in an inconsequential game. So that's all of the 10 games then from match day 33 rounded up. So what's coming up in the next week in Japanese football, you ask? Well, thank you very much. I'll tell you right now, as we've mentioned in passing for numerous teams throughout our review, a Wednesday night sees the Emperor's Cup quarterfinals. On the left-hand side of the draw, it's Kawasaki versus Kashima and Iwata of J2 versus Oita. That will be played at the Ekopa World Cup Stadium. And on the other side of the draw, it's Nagoya and Cerezo Osaka in a Levain Cup final preview and Gamba Osaka versus Urawa at the Suita City Stadium. So, Sam, it's going to be a bumper Wednesday night of action, most definitely. I won't ask you to obviously stick your neck out and predict any of these games, but while we've just talked about Oita, obviously Iwata deserve enormous credit for making it this far, and well, obviously it would have been a while, my memory escapes me at the moment, since we've had a J2 team make it this far. So all the neutrals, I think, will be backing them to make it through to the semi-finals, and obviously from there they'll have a daunting task to take on either Kawasaki or Kashima, but yes, I imagine most neutrals will be pulling for Jubilo on Wednesday night.
I'd have thought so, and I'd probably say they'd go in as favourites. They've obviously got all the momentum with them. It just depends on what teams are put out, because obviously it's a quarter-final and you want to win it, but maybe for Jubilo, promotion's probably a bit more important than this cup competition, especially the mountain they have to climb in the semi-final and final if they are to win this. And Orcha staying in J1 is probably more important as well, so we might see a really exciting reserve team game. But they've all their interesting ties, and Jubilo, I've not seen too much of them this season, but I know that from what I was hearing at the start of the year, no one was particularly convinced by the manager, but he seems to have proven everyone wrong, and they're doing well. They're in J1. J2, are they top of the league at the moment, Jubilo?
Yes, they are, but they've drawn the last two games, I believe.
Oh, okay. So, well, who knows what's going to happen? I think that one's a complete who knows, and the... The other three, yeah, terrific games. I can't predict any of them. I'm not going to. So, it's always exciting, the Emperor's Cup, when it gets down to this stage. Usually, especially, well, Nagoya Cerezo obviously have the cup final at the weekend, but the other four teams, they've got a week after this. They can play their full-strength team. There's no need for rotation. They should be really exciting knockout games. So, I look forward to it. And, yeah, hopefully we get some good action.
Yeah, most definitely. So, Johnny, regular listeners to the J-Talk podcast as a whole will know that you've committed podultry on numerous occasions this season, guested on Extra Time. So you will have seen quite a bit of Iwata this season. So, is Sam spot on there? I mean, yeah, considering they're top of J2, do they go into their quarterfinal against Oita as favourites for you?
Yeah, I'd go along with that. I think if this was like an FA Cup tie, the BBC would be a bit Jubilo looking for the cup upset, which isn't really an upset. I think that even on paper, Jubilo's team's not. You could even argue it's a bit better than Oita. We thought that Lukian is better than any of the options Oita have got in attack, and even his advanced years, Yasuhito Endo pulling the strings in midfield, and they've still got a lot of the players that have got a lot of experience from their time in J1. So. Yeah, I think I kind of go along with what Sam says, that Jubilo needs the promotion's more of an aim, and Oita avoiding relegation is more of an aim. So you might see a lot of rotation in this game. But if it was a strength versus strength game, I'd go for Jubilo.
All right. And so what about on your half of the draw then, Johnny? You're obviously not going to be looking past Urawa, and I wouldn't want to double jinx you or anything like that, and ask you to make a prediction about how you think that game will go. You've obviously just, as you said yourself, you've just had a very difficult league fixture against Red, so it's sure to be a very close encounter on Wednesday night as well. But so, you know, just let's play devil's advocate here and say that you do go through. Are you the sort of person that wants to play a derby in a semi-final, or would you rather Cerezo get beaten by Nagoya, and would you rather take on Grampus? Do you think at this stage of the season, Gumba match up particularly better with either of those two opponents, or you'll obviously just take whatever you can get if you can get past Reds? But are you the sort of supporter that licks your lips at the thought of a derby, or just completely dreads it in the lead up to it?
Well, honestly, when this draw was made, I think we were in the middle of a horrible run. I said, why did we have to have Urawa and Cerezo on our side of the draw? Could we not just sort of have a dignified loss to Kawasaki or something? So if we could get through Urawa, probably to be consistent, I would choose Nagoya. But again, these are all one-off cup games, so you never know. Just maybe one interesting point about Gamba and Urawa. In the 2016 season, Gamba beat Urawa at home in the league, and Urawa beat Gamba at home in the league. But since then, all the league games have been away wins. So, I mean, that might favour Urawa, or it's an Emperor's Cup tie. So maybe the jinx will be reversed, hopefully, from my perspective.
All right, then. Yeah, well, wishing Gumba all the best, but obviously to all the Reds supporters listening as well, we just are hoping for a terrific game, as I'm sure it will be on Wednesday night. And so then to Saturday, Sam, and the Levain Cup final. I'm obviously very much looking forward to it. Nagoya versus Cerezo Osaka. You know, it's a big stage. It's one of the biggest stages in Japanese football, even though we obviously all have huge reservations about the way the competition is structured, this, that, and the other. But you can't deny that once the two teams have made it this far, they want to savour the occasion and they want to lift the trophy. So, I don't know, for me, going into it, I mean, I'm just looking forward to seeing the likes of Mateus. And as we mentioned right back earlier on, the fact that Hiroshi Kiyotake is pretty much back to full fitness and hopefully will be raring to go from the start of this game. So, I'm looking for the real quality players on either side to express themselves. Obviously, I got to see it firsthand last year. My most recent best memory of FC Tokyo, of course, is winning the Levain Cup this January when Leandro basically ran the show. So, yeah, I'm hoping that the likes of Mateus and Kiyotake can really put on a show for the neutrals. And, obviously just made the best team win on Saturday.
Oh, absolutely, and these are always great occasions. And I think, I don't know the exact numbers, Dan Olowitz would be the one to go to with this, but I think they've opened up a bit more of the stadium in terms of their supporters. So this is going to be one of the biggest crowds, maybe the biggest crowd that has been in Japanese football since the start of COVID. So that'll be really interesting and great to see. A bit of noise, a bit of colour maybe. I can't really separate the two teams, to be honest. There's quality on both teams. I thought Cerezo, I don't know if you agree with this, but they played very well, I thought, in the two legs of the League Cup semi-final, and Nagoya likewise. So quality on both teams. Yeah, hopefully all of them play for you. And how's your setup for this? Are you still stuck at home, or are you allowed out to go and commentate elsewhere?
No, it's the same situation as I had in the semi-final. So, slightly challenging on the obviously the smaller computer screen and rather than the large monitor I was able to use for the final last year. But now that I've done it twice in recent times, I'm feeling a bit more confident about how things will go on Saturday. And hopefully it'll be a terrific game. And I'm sure I'll enjoy the experience. So thanks, mate. And Johnny. Again, it's a big occasion, and you'll obviously be supporting Nagoya, obviously. You won't want Cerezo to be winning anything, but, I'm sure you can appreciate it's going to be a terrific occasion for both teams. And, if there can be more supporters in there, then hopefully that'll create a really good atmosphere as well.
Yeah, I think it's a big chance to showcase like Japanese football. I know Sam has mentioned Dan Orlowitz. I think I saw a tweet from him saying that the original plan was to have a kind of open, like a mixed zone at the end of the game to interview players. But Nagoya are still staying in a hotel after coming back from Korea. So I think that's been scrapped. But yeah, if we can have it looking a bit better, more fans in the stadium, more colour, more noise. It's interesting as well because, you commented commentated in the final last year, whereas this year you commentated in the semi-finals and the final. Do you feel has there been more interest from overseas recently, or is it the league trying to push things overseas? Well, what's kind of happening with this kind of like commentary like on YouTube and promoting the league on YouTube and things like that?
Well, yeah, I was quite surprised when they asked me to do the semi-final as well. But yeah, I think it's just part of the a wider push. This season, obviously, they've been doing a terrific job with getting a J2 game on every weekend, and I guess it's just to slowly but surely they're opening themselves up more and more, and I think it's part of it in the past was the fact that they didn't even have the rights to their own product when Sky Perfect just dominated all of the rights, and the J League basically weren't able to do anything independently, whereas I guess as part of this their contract with DAZN, they're able to put more content out rather individually, and they're showcasing the game more and more to an international audience, and I'm happy to obviously play my small part in it. Hoping for a good occasion and a great advertisement for the league on Saturday, and I'm sure it will be. And as we've all said, may the best team win. And I guess we'll leave it there then. So well and truly back to mid-season form for us, back to 90 minutes or so. Regular listeners wouldn't have it any other way, I'm sure. So firstly, Johnny, we'll thank you again for popping back on the podcast. Always terrific to get your thoughts. Obviously you're feeling quite chipper after a Gumba win. We'll hope, as we said earlier, that they can do the business for you on Wednesday night as well, and indeed for the rest of the season. So we'll hopefully catch up again before all is said and done in 2021. Thanks for your time this week.
Thanks again for having me on, Ben. And obviously after a Gamba win and an exciting match week, and I'm going to be at the Marinos Gamba game, so if anyone's in the Kanto area wants to give me a shout, I'm findable on Twitter, so let me know if you fancy meeting up for an hour or so after the game.
Absolutely. Well, you're going to be absolutely flooded with the offers now, Johnny. You can promise you that. It's at Blog Gumba, of course, for Johnny. And you can read Johnny's excellent writings at his Gumba Osaka blog in English. All right. Well, terrific stuff from Johnny, Sam, as we've come to expect, of course. A terrific episode. You've managed to pick yourself up after the events of Sunday evening. So full credit to you for working your way through this episode. And absolutely terrific stuff. We just have to work out what we're going to do on next week's episode, obviously with the cup final on Saturday, but then your full round of J1 on the Wednesday, so we'll have to get our heads together, but we will definitely have some content for our listeners next week, and looking forward to it all unfolding.
Yeah, we'll get our heads together later on, I'm sure, and thank you for only mentioning yesterday's result 4 or 5 times. You really kept it quiet there. So, but other than that, all the best for Saturday. I hope you can keep me awake at 5:05 in the morning. That's your task. But, look forward to listening to you and seeing the cup final.
Thank you very much, Sam. All right, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Johnny Nicol very much for his time on this week's episode. We'd also like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/jtalkpod. And we'd like to thank you, listeners, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week at some point to talk about what's going on in Japanese football. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.